Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 111, Fort Carillon. On the morning of March 10th, 1758, a series of letters arrived in Boston from Southern Secretary William Pitt, announcing that Lord Loudoun was to be replaced as Commander-in-Chief by Major General Abercrombie, as well as the changes in Britain's approach to the war effort that we discussed last week. The Chathamite system. Loudoun had spent the winter planning for the next phase of the war in the usual heavy-handed manner, and it looked as though the colonies had reached their breaking point. Massachusetts was preparing to vote against continuing to supply the war with money and manpower, having previously been the principal contributor. The removal of Loudoun and the shift in tone worked wonders. The governor, Thomas Pownall, called a special session of the Assembly, which met that night to discuss the letters. The next morning, the Assembly voted to raise 7,000 soldiers, days after refusing to raise 2,128 for Loudoun. The shockwave rippled around the continent. Connecticut voted to raise 5,000, Rhode Island 1,000. New Hampshire, 800. Delaware, 300. New York increased its levy to 2,680. Pennsylvania to 2,700. While Virginia doubled its military, raising militiamen to occupy the frontier forts, as well as two regiments for an expedition into the Ohio Valley. Maryland was embroiled in an internal political conflict, so it didn't do anything, but all other colonies increased their forces. Within a month of Pitt's letter, over 23,000 provincials had been raised, and that's not counting the thousands more involved in supplying them. This is truly remarkable, but it needs to be made clear what exactly is happening here. Pitt's policies worked, but not entirely for the reasons he was expecting. There are three key points here. 1. Why Loudoun's policies didn't work. 2. Why Pitt's did. And 3. How this fits into the big picture. To deal with the first point, Loudoun thought the colonials were lazy and selfish. He couldn't understand why they wouldn't sacrifice their own interests for those of the empire. He saw a well-off society in New England that contrasted sharply with that of the rural poor in England and Scotland. It didn't make sense that the New Englanders wouldn't join his army, and that the provincial assemblies wouldn't fund it. This is because Loudoun did not understand what was happening in the colonies. In contrast to Britain, land was plentiful in America. This made people more comfortable. Most were comfortable. There was not an underclass as existed in Britain, an underclass which formed the main body of recruits for the army and the navy, people who were desperate and would take any opportunity. Without this body of desperate people, the army would need to pay a good wage to compete. And then there was the issue of why the colonies wouldn't pay. Simply put, the money wasn't there. The colonies had very little liquid capital, and raising taxes to the level demanded would bring the population to ruin. The provincial assemblies understood this. Loudoun did not. Pitt's policies worked because they allowed the men to serve, and because it allowed the colonies to finance them. Loudoun had a centralising urge. He wanted the colonists to join a single colonial army, but as we've said, this had little appeal. Pitt was more than happy to use provincials and removed the stigma attached to provincial regiments, such as making all officers junior to any regular officers. Pitt was more than happy to take as many of these as the colonies could supply, even if they were not fit for battle and only served for short periods of time. They could do other jobs, freeing up the regimented troops. they could then be paid for with subsidies. To Pitt, it was no different to funding the Prussian war effort. Pitt probably wasn't thinking of the lack of currency in the colonies, and that available land was the reason for why people wouldn't serve in an army, not to mention the political tradition that was building in New England. But that didn't make the policy any less effective. Now, for the final issue, how does this all fit into the big picture? If you remember back to the early 18th century, it was typically characterised by a very hands-off approach to imperial politics. The metropole had let the colonies go their own way, and then, in the late 1740s, they began an attempt to reverse this. Halifax, in particular, if you'll recall that far back, had been pushing for a strong level of centralisation. This was what had led to the creation of Braddock and Loudoun's position, essentially as viceroy. They wanted administrative reforms. The colonies had been resisting this attempt to claim authority. Pitt was a pragmatist who had one objective: win the war. This struggle was of little importance to Pitt when compared to winning the war, and he was prepared to take drastic action to do it. While Pitt differed substantially from Loudoun in terms of policy, their military objectives were quite similar, which may have more to do with the limitations geography imposed than anything else. It was agreed that the British needed to take an offensive action this year, rather than yet another year of defence, but actually doing it would be quite tricky. They had limited options, and none were great. Invading New France through the St. Lawrence was one option, and it was what Loudoun had tried to do in 1757, but came with the difficulties of sea travel, and that Louisbourg was in the way. This was what had stopped Loudoun's expedition. There was another option, what has been called the Lake Champlain Corridor, which would involve taking a string of French forts, including Fort Carillon and Fort St. Frederick. There was the approach up the Mohawk Valley to Lake Ontario, but Lake Ontario was protected by Fort Frontenac and Fort Niagara. If the British wanted to attack through the Ohio, then there was the issue of Fort Duquesne, which could be approached either from the Potomac or from Pennsylvania. Pitt's plan was to go after four targets: Louisbourg, Frontenac, Carillon, and Duquesne. Fort Frontenac was the crucial point between Quebec and the interior, and would leave the advanced forts vulnerable, but this could only work if Fort Duquesne were taken too, given that Duquesne could be resupplied from Illinois. Louisbourg would open up the St. Lawrence, and Carillon, the Lake Champlain Corridor. While Major General Abercrombie was Commander-in-Chief, a number of new men were to lead the campaigns. To command the Louisbourg expedition was Geoffrey Amherst. He would have 14,000 men, and James Wolfe was placed under him. Abercrombie would march against Fort Carillon along with George Augustus, Viscount Howe, with 25,000 men. Before you ask, George Augustus was not that Howe. That was his younger brother, William, who we'll introduce soon enough. They had the objective of holding New York, taking Fort Carillon, and then causing chaos in Canada. Meanwhile, acting brigadier John Forbes was given command of 7,000 with the objective of taking Fort Duquesne through Pennsylvania. The thing which is interesting about these various promotions, Amherst, Wolfe, Howe, and Forbes, is that all four had never had a senior command before. They all, however, had demonstrated ability as administrators. Clearly, Pitt's aide, Lord Legionner, saw that logistics and supply would make or break the campaign. In total, about 50,000 were under arms the British in this campaign. The entire population of Canada was about 75,000. Montcalm commanded perhaps 25,000 men. Previously, the French had used Indian allies to make up the number difference, but as we saw after Fort William Henry, the Indians and the French were no longer on good terms, and were suffering a smallpox epidemic. This was combined with food supply issues as the harvest failed for a second year in succession. Rations were reduced and reduced and reduced again. The only thing that prevented starvation in Quebec was the arrival of food supplies from France in May, but the redirection of supplies for the military caused great civilian suffering. This was not helped by a rapidly deteriorating relationship between the commander, Montcalm, and the governor-general, Valrieu. The problems plaguing New France were very similar to those that had been affecting the American colonies, with the exception that there wasn't a French pit to solve them. King Louis XV and his ministers were losing interest in the American theatre of the war. They saw the path to victory as marching against Hanover, stopping British raids on the coast, and then launching an invasion of Britain. The only thought Versailles really gave to the Americas was protecting Guadeloupe and Martinique, not New France. The first major action of the year was Abercrombie and Howe's campaign against Fort Carillon. Just to give you a better idea of the geography we're talking about here, since I do throw a lot of names at you, New York is quite a big state, but the settled part was all in the southeast. You can think of New York as a right-angled triangle. The 90-degree corner is in the southeast, where New York City is, and then you have a line going north, bordering Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont, and a line going west, bordering Pennsylvania. The hypotenuse, in the northwest, goes along Lake Ontario and the St. Lawrence River. If you go north of New York City, you will follow the Hudson, along the eastern border of New York. About halfway up, you reach Albany, where the river forks. The Hudson continues north, but the Mohawk goes west. The source of the Mohawk is Fort Oswego, if you'll remember that particular disaster for the British. If you follow the Hudson, you reach two lakes, Lake George, and then further north, Lake Champlain. Lake George was guarded on the south side by Fort William Henry, if you remember that particular disaster for the British, and on the north by Fort Carillon, which would later be renamed Fort Ticonderoga. Lake Champlain was guarded on the south side by Fort St. Frederick, and if you followed it north, it would take you almost all the way to Montreal. Got that? Good. Okay, so Abercrombie and Howe gathered their force next to the ruin of Fort William Henry on the south side of Lake George in late June 1758. A force of 16,000 crossed the lake in boats, and by June 6th, they were just 4 miles from Fort Carillon, by the encamped French advanced force, which fled. The British started to loot the camp, but were rallied by Howe, who led the British advanced force. Howe started to pursue the French, where he was almost immediately killed by a musket shot. This led to a huge loss of morale in the British camp. Howe was a lively character, in contrast to Abercrombie, who had the nickname Granny. The British seemed to almost immediately lose purpose. The men were sent around the woods for the rest of the day, not accomplishing anything. The next day, when they were 4 miles from the camp, Abercrombie only marched them halfway there before setting up camp. He ordered his men to prepare an attack, yet did not reconnoitre the fort. Montcalm had arrived at the fort on June 30th, and found it weakly defended. Reinforcements and supplies arrived, but not enough to let Carillon survive a siege. By July 8th, Montcalm had about 3,500 men and less than a week's supply of food. The French built a defensive barrier about 3/4 of a mile away from the fort. This barrier was protected by felled trees, whose knotted branches would make it difficult for infantry to advance through and made vulnerable. It was an extreme gamble, and Abercrombie could have easily forced a withdrawal from this position by bringing in some of his artillery. But he set a junior lieutenant to reconnoitre the fort, and he, after a quick look, recommended storming the position. Abercrombie did not check himself, or bother to get a second opinion. Instead, he called a council of war, usually used to decide a method of attack, but the only issue discussed was whether the infantry should attack in lines of three or four. The infantry were sent into the mess, got tangled in the branches, and were shot. The British then sent in more men who were shot. Abercrombie wasn't even there. He was supervising entrenching their camp, about a mile away from the battle. He received regular dispatches, but didn't seem to understand what was happening, as he just ordered more attacks. He finally went there at the end of the day, and saw that 2,000 of his men were dead or wounded. He had successfully snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, and began his retreat. Yet, he didn't have anyone tell the men why they were retreating. A rumour spread that the French were about to pounce, and a stampede started. The British were fleeing from an army that was only a quarter of its size, and wasn't even pursuing. Throughout my podcasting career, I've produced some 300 or 400 episodes. I've covered a lot of battles, and this has to be the strangest. Captain of the 44th Foot, Charles Lee, yes, that Charles Lee, wrote, quote, "These proceedings must undoubtedly appear most astonishingly absurd to people who were at a distance, but they are still more glaringly so to us who were upon the spot. There was one hill in particular which seemed to offer itself as an ally to us. It immediately commanded the lines from hence two small pieces of cannon, well planted, must have drove the French in a very short time from their breastwork, notwithstanding some of our cannon was brought up and in readiness. This was never thought of, which, one would have imagined, must have occurred to any blockhead who was not absolutely so far stunk in idiotism as to be obliged to wear a bib and bells." End quote. Montcalm spent the rest of the summer improving the defences of Fort Carillon, knowing that while Abercrombie had been humiliated into taking a defensive position, and was now working on a new fortification by Fort William Henry, it was only a matter of time before the British would attack again. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.